Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to DW's Africa Link program this Tuesday, the 23rd of January 2018. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. We are also live on Facebook, DW Africa.
On the program today, women activists in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, take to the streets to protest against sexual harassment and allegations of rape of breastfeeding mothers at the country's main hospital.
The authorities, who bear the highest duty of care for these mothers, offer a suggestion box as a means of keeping women safe. With the threat of death standing in their faces, who would dare speak up?
Also in the program, a UN panel of experts propose that UN peacekeepers should change the way they operate to reverse a worrying trend of escalating fatalities.
And we'd like to ask you at this moment, do you think that the UN should use force in cases when it is threatened by warring factions in Africa's hotspots? Just go to our Facebook, DW Africa, leave your comment there and read it live on air. These are some of the stories we've lined up for you, but first is a chance, of course, to listen to what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Nearly 100 journalists and politicians were arrested across Turkey on Tuesday after anti-terror police staged raids to quash critics of Turkey's military operation against Kurdish positions in Afrin, Syria. The German daily newspaper Tage Zeitung wrote on Twitter that two of their journalists were arrested under suspicion of inciting the people to violence. Turkish authorities, meanwhile, have banned all rallies and protests in the capital Ankara during the Afrin operation. Hundreds of Kenyan women took to the streets in the capital Nairobi on Tuesday to peacefully protest against the country's largest public hospital after dozens of women claimed to have been sexually abused there. Unjeri Mawingi, a health empowerment rights activist at the demonstration, said new mothers were raped at the Kenyatta National Hospital soon after giving birth.
Women have complained that they've been raped when they're going to nurse their babies. We want the hospital to take responsibility and provide new moms and their children a facility that is safe.
The hospital has denied the allegations but confirmed that it would review the case and would take appropriate action if necessary. Kenya's health minister has ordered an investigation. Legendary South African jazz musician and anti-apartheid activist Hugh Masekela has died in Johannesburg at the age of 78 after a decade-long battle with prostate cancer. The so-called father of South African jazz used his music to spread awareness about oppressive white minority rule in South Africa. His family issued a statement on his behalf, thanking the millions of worldwide fans for their support. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. New Liberian President George Weah has appointed the first members of his cabinet one day after being sworn in to replace Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Among the appointments, Weah chose his so-called right-hand man and chairman of Weah's Congress for Democratic Change Party, Nathaniel McGill, as Minister of State and Chief of Staff. No women, however, have so far been chosen to join his cabinet. A 7.9 magnitude earthquake struck off Alaska's Kodiak Island early on Tuesday, prompting a brief tsunami warning for much of coastal Alaska and the U.S. West Coast. A police spokesman on Kodiak said no quake damage or large waves were reported, but Kodiak resident Nathaniel Moore described a massive shake as the earthquake hit.
There hasn't been any damage or injuries as far as I know of. Everyone that we know is safe, but it was a massive shake.
The tsunami warning for the U.S. has been lifted. And now in sports, several Russian athletes, including six-time speed skating gold medalist Viktor Ahn, have been banned from competing next month during the 2018 Winter Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea. The International Olympic Committee decided not to permit members of the Russian skating and skiing teams to participate over Russia's ongoing doping scandal. Russia's Olympic Committee has requested further explanation and has denounced the ban. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
Welcome back once again to the program, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jane Nyinge. We start off in Kenya, where hundreds of women took to the streets of the capital, Nairobi, protesting rape allegations and sexual harassment of breastfeeding mothers at the Kenyatta National and Referral Hospital, the country's largest public hospital. More than 30 women who claim to have experienced sexual abuse at the hospital were among the protesters.
Now, from the streets, the women stormed the hospital premises to demand an end to the harassment. And as DW's Rhoda Odhiambo in Nairobi reports, a standoff ensued between the hospital staff and the activists.
Anger. From women activists to staff workers at Kenyatta National Hospital, 4 days after the workers were accused of sexually assaulting lactating mothers. The rape allegations that were made public on a Facebook page last week Friday sparked a public outrage in the country. And today, women of different ages, armed with nothing but placards, purple ribbons and their voice, made it clear that they want safe public hospitals where they can be treated without fear. The women first marched all the way from the city center to the health ministry offices to present their petition and later to the Kenyatta National Hospital. They want Health Minister Cleopa Mailu and the Kenyatta National Hospital boss Lily Koros to resign for failing to address the matter with the urgency it deserves. Rita Mutheu, the organizer of the peaceful protest, says the two have failed to protect women.
Worse is the authorities, who bear the highest duty of care for these mothers, offer a suggestion box as a means of keeping women safe. With the threat of death standing in their faces, who would dare speak up and risk not having the chance to raise the beautiful bundle of blessing they just delivered? A suggestion box is an insult and mockery to the pain of these women have suffered.
Kenyatta National Hospital workers say the accusation against them have tainted their image, and since no one has come out to say she's a victim, the women need to apologize for spreading wrong information. Pius Liboy is the chair of the workers' union.
We are tired of being abused. We treat patients day and night, but today those people who lied to the media that they were raped or abused must make a statement with the police, failure to which we will sue you. You cannot taint our name.
That report was compiled by Rhoda Odhiambo in Nairobi. And Jane, as you've heard in the report, many people are really angry about what has happened at Kenyatta National Hospital, or KNH, as they call it.
Yes, indeed.
And of course, they went on Twitter. The protests trended with the hashtag #EndKNH, wrote, and people wrote. Mutoni Maingi said, "I took my mom to her first protest. Very proud of her."
And activist Shifa Okore says what's happening at Kenyatta National Hospital is exactly what is wrong with Kenya, that the staff is so willing to defend a system that is clearly rotten at the expense of everyone, or everyone seeking justice.
That's a tough comment from activist Shifa. Of course, Maggie Matolo wrote and said, "New mothers should not be raped. Should we line up the victims so that we believe?" She questions.
Absolutely, because I think no one would like to be tagged as a rape victim, and that is why it's so hard if you are raped to come openly and say I was raped.
And especially when you're a young mother, you know, you have to breastfeed your child and you have to move floors, and I mean, was it three floors to go?
Yeah, absolutely. They are in third floor and they have to go and breastfeed their children in first floor.
Carolina Kamau says we must bring back dignity and humanity in our hospitals.
And we have this one from Teddy Aswani. He says, our mothers and sisters are our patient, not prey.
Anyway, keep those comments flowing and we will read them whenever we can.
Moving on, Turkey has intensified its offensive dubbed Olive Branch against Kurdish militia in northern Syria. The Turkish army crossed into the Kurdish enclave of Afrin in northern Syria 4 days ago. Afrin is controlled by the Kurdish YPG militia, which has been a key U.S. ally in the fight of the so-called Islamic State, or IS. But Turkey sees the YPG as a terrorist organization and has urged the U.S. to stop backing them. Meral Sisik from the Kurdish Center for Women's Affairs spoke to DW's Amrita Chima, and she explains how they are experiencing the offensive.
Very few people are leaving the city. They are staying there. They are resisting in shelters, underground shelters, or in the houses, because they are saying that they won't live in a city controlled either by the Turkish army or by Islamist forces.
Now, the Kurdish militant groups have supported the United States in the fight against so-called Islamic State. Do they feel in some sense abandoned by Washington in this conflict now?
I mean, if you say abandoned, there should be something like a strategic relationship. And the Kurdish forces always said that it's a kind of tactical relationship for them, and that for them their own strength is important. So, sure, on one side, because you are cooperating against a common enemy, and suddenly you're in a situation where the whole Western states are in a way supporting the Turkish offensive against the Kurds. But according to the statements, we can say that they are ready. They said, we won't ask for any support. We believe in our own strength, and we will defend our city until the end.
Now, the Turkish government, of course, argues that the YPG in northern Syria is linked to the PKK, which is considered a terrorist organization, the Kurdish organization in Turkey. What do you make of those claims?
I mean, sure, they also said or stated that they have ideological ties, but at least, I mean, PYD is not PKK. The Democratic Administration of Canton Afrin is not completely PKK. So, I mean, although there are some political or ideological ties, you can't say it's completely the same.
Now, you are in touch with the Kurdish community in exile living here in Germany. What do they feel about this offensive, and what kind of action are they planning?
I mean, they started just on Saturday, the day the offensive started, with their protest actions, and more or less all European cities where Kurdish people are organized, and not just in the Kurdish diaspora in Europe, but also in other parts of Kurdistan and countries. They are mobilizing daily. They are preparing for a central demonstration or rally on Saturday in Cologne. But all the people, I mean, they are very furious. They want to organize or mobilize all the democratic forces to stop the Turkish offensive.
Meral Çiçek from the Kurdish Center for Women's Affairs speaking to DW's Amrita Chima.
Now, UN peacekeeping forces need to change the way they operate and not shy away from using force to reverse a worrying trend of escalating fatalities. That's according to a new report made public on Monday this week. Casualties have spiked since 2013, with 200 personnel in UN peacekeeping missions killed by acts of violence, more than during any other five-year period in history. Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to Annette Lejeunaar from the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa, and I began by asking her why the UN has taken so long to realize that there is a need to change the rules of engagement where its peacekeepers are deployed. Take a listen.
First of all, I don't think that the UN has not paid attention to the matter. It is an ongoing process. To make a statement that this report addresses the use of force is the wrong perspective. The broad areas to reduce fatalities in missions is, first of all, a changing mindset so that personnel are aware of the risk and empowered to take initiative to deter it. There's a lack of awareness by your general UN staff to observe. Now, the UN in a number of high-risk missions, in all high-risk missions, has got special training to enhance security awareness. Then the second point is we need to train our staff better.
In case UN peacekeepers or the blue helmets were to change the rules of engagement in combat zones, do you think this would lead to the de-escalation of violence?
It may be. This depends on what situation you are in. If there's attacks from extremist elements and you kill them.
I was speaking to Annette Lejeunaar, a researcher on peacekeeping missions at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa. And in case you're just joining us, this is DW's Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jane Nyinge. But first, to mark the passing of jazz musician Hugh Masekela, we bring you this report from Tuzo Kumalo.
The passing away of Hugh Masekela has left his fans, musicians and other players in the industry devastated. South African actress and musician Mara Lowe became emotional as she described how great a musician he was.
I'm very heartbroken by Hugh. Was my favorite musician of all time. He was for me the best that this country has produced.
Born on 4 April 1939, Masekela spent his early years in a conservative small town east of Johannesburg, surrounded by coal mines that relied on cheap black labor. It was not until the age of 14 that he received his first trumpet from a Catholic priest, Father Trevor Huggleston, after seeing the talent in the young Masekela. Since then, until the time of his demise, he never looked back. His hits like Soweto Blues, Stimela, and Bring Him Back Home, meaning Nelson Mandela, added steam to the fight against apartheid. The South African Musician Association has paid tribute to the father of South African jazz, whose trumpet never went silent when something was not right in the society. South African broadcaster Tim Mudise says Masekela had a rare talent.
It was easy for him to play with anybody, anywhere, anytime, with South Americans, Caribbeans, the Americans, the Europeans, African musicians. Anywhere, anytime was music time for Hugh Masekela.
Maguzu is an upcoming South African Maskandi musician and also great admirer of Masekela's works.
I'd like to send my deepest condolences to the family of Hugh Masekela. It's really a great loss, not only for the family but for the country as well. May his soul rest in peace. He will always be remembered. The country has lost a legend.
And for his fans, hits like Kaoleza, Tanai, Strawberries, and Chileshe, among others, will forever form part of their lives for many years to come.
Well, that report on the death of jazz maestro Hugh Masekela was compiled by Tuzo Kumalo. And his death, Jane, I should say at this moment that it has triggered an outpouring of tributes to his music, his long career, and I mean his anti-apartheid activism. One of them is President Jacob Zuma, who also lauded Hugh Masekela, describing him as an internationally acclaimed jazz artist, a legendary trumpeter, a cultural activist, and liberation struggle veteran. These are so many accolades, I mean, too.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Because this is not a guy who was huge only in South Africa, but I think so many parts of Africa.
Yes, and actually, you know, many people have been commenting. Just to remind you before we read some of your comments, is that Hugh Masekela died at the age of 78 in what his family described as a long battle and determined battle against, you know, of battling prostate cancer. Jen, please read some of the comments.
Yeah, DW's Privilege Mushaniri, he's in Zimbabwe, says, sad South Africa and the world robbed of a great man. Sadly, figures like him cannot be replaced.
Martin Lungu refers back to the story we've just aired. You know, in the story, there was that, you know, iconic song, Bring Back Nelson Mandela. He says, bring back home, you know. I want to see him. And I mean, to Martin Lungu, he says, these are some of the best lyrics. He's had music for a lifetime.
And Bakare Olutumi says, I love his track, Marketplace. Rest in peace. Which track do you love?
I mean, yeah. Bring Back Nelson Mandela, I mean, it was a huge, big track. Even, yeah. You know, it was in so many movies like Sarafina, you know.
Absolutely.
It's featured in so many movies, those, you know, fighting apartheid and also those promoting, you know, equality in South Africa. Martin Chifol from Cameroon, but he lives in South Africa. He says, through art, he was a freedom fighter, one of the artists who fought for black awareness in South Africa, an artist who brought winds of change to South Africa. Continue to rest in peace until, what he says, we meet again.
Please do bring those comments or send those comments on our Facebook page at DW Africa.
Africa on the move.
Now to northern Ghana, where fake honey continues to be sold at the market, posing a serious health risk to residents. Unscrupulous business people mix sugar with other components and sell it as honey to unsuspecting customers. One non-governmental organization wants to change this unfortunate trend. The Community Partnership for Youth and Female Development has embarked on a campaign to sensitize the public to take up beekeeping in a bid to produce quality honey and understand more about the product itself. From Tamale, Ghana, Maxwell Souk reports.
The crackling sound of dry leaves resonates as I walk through beehives owned by William Sapaka Adamango, Central Gonja District of the Northern Region. It's a bright, sunny day, and bees are buzzing in this apiary.
That's an apiary. Mm-hmm. We call it some apiary, some apiary, where you keep the beehives. That's an apiary.
William Apaka is a trained beekeeper. He tells me bee farming in the northern part of the country has its share of challenges, including theft of honey and also the threat of wildfires. There is also the problem of adulterated honey flooding Ghanaian market. People mix honey with different compositions, including melted ash forms, water and sugar, and sell it to unsuspecting customers. Hemas C. Beku has sold adulterated honey before.
People buy the honey from the farmers and because they want to make profit. They adulterate it and put it in the market, and people are suffering with it. And myself, some period, I went out of business because of fake honey. So I'm very aware that there's fake honey in the system.
The demand for honey compared to sugar is high in Ghana, according to Kasim Musa, a honey retailer in Tamale. He tells me his honey business keeps on getting better day by day.
I can even see that nowadays the market of the honey is better than the sugar itself right now.
To help fight adulterated honey, especially in northern Ghana, the Community Partnership for Youth and Women Development, a non-governmental organization, has been working with communities, training and sensitizing them on bee farming and how to produce good honey. Jacob Abukari is an apiculture expert and works with these communities.
We go into training them to come out with standard honey and then quality honey that can meet the demand and for the demand for consumers, so that it doesn't bring about poor quality or adulterated honey in the system.
According to health experts, the effects of consuming adulterated honey depend on what composition is used to mix it. For Jacob Abukari, beekeeping has a long value chain than it is currently explored.
My main aim is that there are a lot of women or young girls who move from the northern sector to the southern sector in search for non-existing jobs. And then at the end of every farming season, the women or the men of farming sit idle doing nothing. So we train them so that from their farm, they can go into the honey harvesting, and then there they'll increase their income level, thereby improving their livelihood.
At the moment, It is difficult to combat this adulteration of honey because the Ghanaian Food and Drugs Authority has not explicitly come out clear on the matter, despite public complaints.
Maxwell Sook reporting from Ghana. Isaac, are you able to identify the fake and the original honey?
Definitely. I did some agriculture at school, and of course, you know, I mean, honey is honey. You can't fake it.
Of course,
better test, you know, from the, you don't have to put it on your tongue. No, you just have to use the tips of your fingers, and you'll know really, you can distinguish the fake honey from the real honey made by the bees, not this honey mixed from sugar and other components, which I don't know. Maybe it's the dregs of sugar cane and all that. Some people have many things they come up with too.
Let me trust you at the moment because we don't have any honey here.
Thank you very much. I would have told you that this is bio honey or this is, you know, some has some other additives, Jen. we'll be back right after this.
Focus Europe.
Now, the Catalonian nationalist bid for independence from Spain, which saw separatist parties win elections in the province just before Christmas, has been met with stony disapproval in other countries around Europe. But that is not necessarily the case in some of the Europe's regions. Brittany, the large territory that has formed the northwest of France for the past few centuries, has seen a huge rise of enthusiasm for Breton culture in recent years. While showing little enthusiasm for the nationalist politics that get so many people fired up in Scotland, the Basque country of Flanders. But some now believe that independence for Brittany is just a matter of time. This report from John Lorison in the Breton town of Farne.
Arriving at the rehearsal of the Van Bagad, or Breton Pipe Band, Johan Loret is musical director.
Le mouvement Bagad est né dans les années 40, à partir des années 40.
The Bagad movement started in the 1940s. We wanted to imitate our Scottish cousins, so we created pipe bands like Scottish pipe bands, but with a Breton twist. So we imported snare drums and bagpipes and added our own instrument, a bit like an oboe, called the bombard. When I started playing in a Bagad, most of the musicians were old. In fact, people considered the whole idea old-fashioned. That has completely changed. It's become really popular.
In Paris, I go to visit a man for whom the Breton cultural revival is just the beginning. Gilles Martin Chauffier is the editor of Paris Match magazine and the author of several novels and a history of Brittany. Breton nationalism, let alone separatism, is a negligible political force. Nationalist parties get 1 or 2% of the Breton vote. But Martin Chauffier's new book is called The Happiness of Being Breton, The Regions Against the Nations, in which he applauds the Catalan initiative and predicts Breton independence.
A number of regions with a high level of personality are suddenly considering that what happens in Catalonia might happen elsewhere. A few years ago, you thought if you are Scottish, if you want independence, you will have to leave England and Europe. And that's what Brussels said, if you leave England, you will leave Europe. What is happening now in Catalonia is that Brussels never said to Catalonia, if you leave Spain, you will leave Europe. Spain has told it, but Brussels did not confirm it. It's true that Brittany doesn't want to leave France, but when they will see that Catalans, that Flanders, that Venice, that Corsica, that Scotland will become independent, the idea necessarily is going to emerge.
But if it might one day, it hasn't yet at the Bagad de Van, in any case, where the people I talk to make a clear distinction between affirming Breton identity and willing the rebirth of an independent Breton nation. Playing the bombard is first of all about playing Breton music and defending Breton culture generally. Young musician Marine Lestrade tells me, do you consider yourself a nationalist? I ask her.
No.
That report was by John Lorenson in the Breton town of Van. And before we leave you, a reminder of main story. Women activists in Kenya's capital Nairobi took to the streets to protest against sexual harassment and allegations of rape of breastfeeding mothers at the country's main hospital. We also have a video that was shot by one of our correspondents in Nairobi,
yes,
Andrew Wasike. So, Jen, they can go to our Facebook page.
DW Africa.
And on behalf of the rest of the team, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. Thank you so much for your time.